It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 5.2.
Chopping tentacles off of Harry Mulbeast, brought to you courtesy of Cthulhu.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And today we have with us Nick Mamatas. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So I guess the first thing I actually want to start off with is, I should have asked this before. It's Haikasoru, right?
That's right.
Okay, so
basically, it is the words high castle as a Japanese person might say them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I did not know that.
Do you remember in The Man in the High Castle, it's basically an alternative history of World War II, in which the Axis wins, and the Japanese have taken over California. And Haikasoru is owned by Viz Media, a Japanese firm located in California. So the idea was that we'd be taking over the West with Japanese science fiction.
That makes such a ridiculous amount of sense.
I really should have picked that up.
Painful. Well, do you speak Japanese, Sean?
Not a word. Nope, not a word. Boss, Masumi Washington, who coined the term Haikasoru, said basically, I'm her English language brain.
Gotcha.
So she's Japanese, and she reads Japanese. And when we choose our books, for those who don't know what we're talking about yet, Haikasoru is an imprint of Japanese science fiction, fantasy, and horror in translation. We've been around for about 2 years, have about 22 books out now, including Philip K. Dick Award runner-up, and Shirley Jackson a nominee, and one of our books, All You Need Is Kill, is being developed to a motion picture by Warner Brothers. Anyway, my boss chooses, from existing Japanese science fiction and fantasy, say 12 books to have a machine translate a couple chapters of, and then I go through these things, and together we pick out which ones to do each season.
Okay. Well, how did you actually get involved with Haikasoru?
Well, it was 2008, and this was when capitalism was collapsing. And I was looking for a job, and what do you know, they were actually hiring in 2008. And I applied for the job, and they called me in for a telephone interview, and I talked to them for about half an hour, and at one point, one of the two people who interviewed me asks, so are you a big fan of anime and manga? Because here at Viz Media, that's what we do. And I said, no. And I thought to myself, oh, that was a bad thing to say, but it turned out to be the good thing to say, because they didn't want sort of an otaku, an anime fanboy. They want someone who really knew science fiction, was more interested in pro science fiction than in their normal product.
Oh, okay.
And that, I qualified. I'd done some editing work. I'd done some work in translation before. I have a very long CV with, you know, short stories and a couple of novels and a lot of, you know, articles. I know a lot of people inside science fiction, so I was the kind of person who could be plugged in right away and start producing these books.
That's right, because you edited Clark's World.
Yes, I edited Clark's World. I also did a few freelance editing jobs here and there for Prime Books. I was once the editor for Sawskull Press, which was an underground sort of punk publishing press.
Oh.
Earlier in the decade. I did a scholarly book with my friend KC from the Korean, so I had some translation experience with Asian languages, and it all happened to match up.
That's awesome.
So basically you've done pretty much everything under the sun.
Mm-hmm. Except have an office job. This is my first job.
Yeah, who really wants one of those anyway?
Just so a lot of the concerns were things like, can you use the photocopy machine? Like, no.
What makes doing something like Haikasoru different from what you've done in the past?
Well, work in translation is quite different. For one thing, we're dealing with a finished product.
Right.
If I have a book that's listed to me or a story, I can say, add 2,000 words, take away 8,000 words, change the ending. With the translated fiction, you have to stay true to what's actually already there. So sometimes it's a 50,000-word novel, which I love. In fact, I hope there'd be more 50,000-word novels out there. Sometimes it's a 250,000-word novel, three novels in one. We've had a book out for about 6 months now called Marduk Scramble by To Ubukata. It was in Japan, published as three novels. the first novel ends with the main character looking up and there's a gun in her face. Now, if I put out that novel and said, okay, we'll have the follow-up for you in 2 years, I'd probably be killed at WorldCon.
Rioting in the streets, yeah.
In Japan, of course, they can put out these books very quickly. They put them out on a monthly basis or even sometimes a weekly basis, almost like the periodicals. So we had to put in all three volumes in one gigantic volume.
Okay.
To make sure you get the complete story.
Yeah.
I guess the other big thing is, of course, you know, why do you buy a book? Why does the average person buy a book? The average person buys a book because they've read something by that author before. So an imprint and translation is pretty much all first-time authors as far as the American market is concerned. As far as booksellers are concerned, as far as, you know, fans are concerned, that sort of thing. So two challenges that don't exist in other imprints.
Because everything's like a debut novel.
Absolutely right.
What would you, because I mean, I've not read a lot of Japanese fiction. I've read manga and I've watched, you know, my fair share of anime. Mm-hmm. What would you say are like some key differences between Japanese genre fiction and stuff we're typically used to here, if anything?
Well, with SF, I can't really speak on mystery or things like that. But with SF and fantasy, I'd say that one, the manga panel is very important. It sort of influences point of view inside a scene, the same way that the motion picture camera might influence point of view inside a scene in an American novel. So scenes work slightly differently. A flashback may not close. A character may seemingly vanish for a few pages and pop up again. They've not gone anywhere. They've just been in the back of the panel. You can get away with characters speaking but not being identified. In a room full of people, someone might say, oh, then someone walks in. He's a famous professor. He says this. So I think those are some differences. Those are minor differences. They're apparent to me mostly because I'm very closely working with the paragraphs and sentences for you know, days at a time. I guess in general it's very interesting because people have been complaining for years online and whatnot that there's no more positive science fiction, no more science fiction with positive views of the future, no more hard science fiction that's really hard SF. It's all, you know, faking the physics or having fantastical or almost magical things happen, and that there's very little SF with female lead characters and very little SF with people of color involved. Now, Haikusuro books and Japanese fiction in general have all of these things, often in the same book.
Hmm.
So you can find, we have a series called Rocket Girl. We have two books in the Rocket Girl series, which are about sort of a private or a semi-private space program that's having some trouble launching their astronauts in space because they're too heavy. So they decide to recruit 13-year-old girls instead. And it's very funny and very cute, but it's also super hard science fiction, right? It was produced in cooperation with JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency. So it's hard SF for young girls and young people of color, in a way, you know. And yet, that's the kind of thing that is not seen in American audience. You know, we segregate our market by sex, right? The hardest stuff is for boys and for men and for libertarians who want to rule the planet, that kind of thing, and fantasy and whatnot, those are for the girls. So Japanese SF does a lot of things that some people wish American SF would do more often, and that's part of why I like the job a lot.
Agreed. So when you're marketing these, I mean, how do you go about doing that? I mean, do you target, as we do in America, with the different age groups and whatnot, or do you just kind of put it out there for everybody?
Well, we're trying to get different audiences. We have the manga anime audience. There are people who just love anything with the Japanese popular culture, and they'll buy these books. Often right. They'll be confused by them. They'll say, well, this is a really hard book. It's a lot about philosophy and crazy stuff. This is not a cute comic book, but some of them have really grown to like them. And we're aiming for the mainstream science fiction audience. I sort of identify different audiences, like the people who are complaining about the lack of hard science fiction. I love hard science fiction.
Me too.
I'm not a fan of right-wing science fiction that just pretends to be hard science fiction. You know, all the physics is wrong, all the science is bad, all the economics is bad, but it seems hard because it has some sort of notion of rigor, notion of philosophical rigor,
mm-hmm.
Which does not, you know, fool me anymore. It did when I was 14, but not anymore. So where I'm trying to find that audience. For other things, we have like our version of an urban fantasy that we put out. We have our version of a historic fantasy that we put out called, we have two books so far, Dragon Sword and Windchild, and Mirror Sword and Shadow Prince by Noriko Ogiwara. And the same way that Tolkien used these sort of seminal myths of the West to create the Lord of the Rings, she uses, you know, the arrival of Buddhism and the arrival of Shinto in Japan to create these sort of fantasy adventures. So we try to find things that are analogous to some Western SF or Western fantasy as well.
Just a random question, because I have one of those, the ones you were just mentioning. And I'm very curious, do you treat your books with green tea?
You smell like tea?
Yes.
Actually, if I remember correctly, Sean, you won a copy.
Yeah.
On haikosuro.com, every time a new book comes out, I give a little giveaway. And you were one of the winners, yes. I have no idea how that happened. I don't even drink tea. I don't even drink hot liquids. Actually, my wife is from England, and she drinks tea all the time, and she's very upset with me that I don't drink tea.
All right. Will someone please let me in on this joke?
It's true. He got a book. It smells like tea to him.
It does. I sniffed this book for like half an hour. I kid you not.
It's true. Usually he only sniffs book for 20 minutes, but this one was half an hour.
I couldn't stop. It smelled so good. I'm green tea. I'm a huge green tea person. So
I'm sorry, honey. You kind of disturb me sometimes, though. I'm just saying.
I'm sorry.
So, Sean, do you sniff all your mail or just books?
Mostly just books. I mean, if a book smells really good, I'll smell it for... This is really weird.
So, okay, I'm going to get back to the topic. Do you find that there's an additional challenge since you are only releasing, primarily releasing as ebooks, correct?
No!
Oh, you aren't? Okay, I'm sorry.
There are certainly challenges. Here's the main challenge, right?
Right.
People are curious about Japanese SF. They buy a book, they read it, they enjoy it, that's it.
Right.
Well, I've read Japanese SF now, I've got a book. They don't think, what else is out there? What's the Japanese soft science fiction like? What is this other book like? They just think that, I read one example of Japanese SF. I read one book like this. That must be the only book I need to read. That's a big challenge for us. I mean, there's some xenophobia inside the audience. Not a huge amount, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that everyone's like a screaming racist or anything, but this is the idea, Japanese science fiction. Here's an example of it. Good, I am now well-rounded.
I could see that happening. I mean, the only reason I ask is because things like Rocket Girls, I've got a 9 and 10 year old daughters. So obviously things like that are very difficult to find in the American,
you're welcome.
Book Jennifer. Field. So thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, I will be buying those.
And they're paper books, so you can compare them up, buy another copy. It's fine.
Right, exactly. And I don't have a Kindle, so screw you all. no, I mean, it is. It's almost impossible to find good books with good female characters that also are hard science fiction.
Yes.
And, almost impossible that my 9 and 10 year old daughters are going to read
right.
and enjoy. If not entirely impossible. Thank you. I appreciate it. And that's the only reason I asked, because when obviously many of us are still using the bookstore. However, rarely that happens these days now.
Yeah.
And I had not seen your books yet. So, and
it's
I'm wondering if that's just because there's still that,
I think one
people being uncomfortable with still the xenophobia aspect and,
I don't know if that's the case. I think
at least in mainstream stores.
Well, one thing that I think has happened sometimes, I know happens sometimes, is that they'll see a Japanese face on the cover and put it in the manga section. Label them as science fiction, they're prose novels. Often they tend to migrate to the manga section. And, sometimes it's not even that bad. We've had several books by Miyuki Miyabe, who's a wonderful Japanese writer, sort of like a Nora Roberts type of character. Super famous over there. Tons of genres over there, just cranks these books out. Really famous. And she's had some manga out here, too, and sometimes those books do sell better in the manga section. We did a book with her just now, just last week, called Aiko. It's based on the PlayStation 2 game, sort of the legendary cult classic game, and it's been selling very well, and I think it's selling very well in various sections of the bookstore. Like, you might find it with the video game books, or you might find it in the SF, or you might just find it on the table in front, or you might find it in the manga section, so it can be tricky. Also, 600 bookstores have closed this year so far.
Right.
Right. Most of the borders is almost gone now, they haven't been refreshing their books. They haven't got the most recent books because why sell them to people who won't pay you for them? And some Barnes & Nobles have closed and that kind of thing. Even here in San Francisco, there's no real big bookstore in downtown SF anymore.
Right.
Right. The Barnes & Noble and Borders closed, and that was pretty much it. There are a couple of smaller great stores like Books Incorporated and whatnot that don't really concentrate on science fiction. But these books, and any book these days, can be hard to find when every bookstore around you is closed.
Yeah.
Yeah, we still at least have a Barnes & Noble. Oh. Something, anyway. We also, I mean, an hour away, we have a great independent bookstore in Santa Cruz. But only because if they're getting categorized in other sections, obviously the children's books, children's books, YA, tends to be fairly whitewashed, period.
Sure.
So that's the only reason that I've been curious about it, because if I haven't seen it there, it does mean that it's somewhere else, hopefully.
Right. It's probably in the SF section, might be in the manga.
Right.
Yeah, right. My local BNN, Barnes & Noble, has, I mean, I think they've carried almost every book from Hikasoru, I think, because every time I go in there, there's like a new one. So. Yeah.
And you buy it.
I bought a couple.
There's more copies for your friends.
I bought Harmony by Project Ito, and I have another one, too, somewhere.
But I'm not allowed to buy books anymore.
Well, I don't buy as many books as I used to. Largely,
I buy them for my kids, though. I am allowed to buy books for my kids, which is why I love when somebody mentions kids' books, because then I'm like, oh, honey, I have to go to the bookstore, and I can spend money on books. I've gone down from $100 a month habit, so.
I actually have a question kind of related to that the issue of, like, the xenophobia, because one of the other things about categorizing books in bookstores, like, for example, we have the African-American fiction section, which I've always thought was a strange section to have. I mean, it's just fiction written by African Americans. Yeah. Are you at all worried that the same thing might happen to Japanese fiction?
Oh, I don't think so, partially because there's not enough of it. I mean, the African American section is pretty politically fraught on some level, but honestly, a lot of that comes from clientele. They want to have a black section, the primarily black readers, but of course white readers read these books as well. They want to go to a section where they can see all black readers and follow their favorite series like anything else. Same thing like science fiction or fantasy or local interest or whatnot, or Judaica or that kind of thing. So it, in some way, it's sort of disconcerting to see James Baldwin next to Thongalicious, right? But in the fiction literature section, we see, Jane Austen next to some chick that book too. So it can be tricky, but those books seem to sell better when they're grouped together. And perhaps on some level, it's better for the authors and better for the readers to have them grouped together, even if it seems almost like a segregation.
Yeah.
But for Japanese, I don't think there's going to be enough demand across genres for that to create a Japanese section or to create an Asian fiction section or that kind of thing.
Hmm.
Obviously, I'd want them. If there was one, I'd want them in both. I want them in science fiction, an Asian section in the front of the store too. Perhaps slipped into bags as people are leaving mysteriously.
So obviously, Hikasoru has been reasonably successful in getting Japanese science fiction and other fiction over here. Yep. What do you think that they have done right in terms of bringing to Americans foreign books to the United States and translating them and going through the whole process, which has proven to be, to some people, countries almost impossible, not cost effective, etc.
Oh, well, in general, you're speaking about in general Japanese fiction versus other nations?
Versus other, yes.
Well, a few things. I mean, one, of course, there's an enormous amount of trade. Japan's a huge economy. It's the second largest economy in the world, or the third. It's a relatively free society as well. I mean, I'm sure China has a gigantic economy and a big publishing industry, but there's a lot of political oppression there. So the books tend to not be very interesting because they have to be party approved, not so in Japan. And of course, the first or earliest cultural popular cultural exchange has been cartoons, anime and manga, Speed Racer, Star Blazers, Astro Boy. And those are easy to translate. It's easier to translate a manga when it's 3,000 words in a story. And most of the words are, So that opened up space for the books in a lot of ways. It created a generation of translators, for one. It's hard to find, say, a Serbian to English translator.
Right.
Relatively easy to find a Japanese to English translator because of manga, anime, and video games.
That's good.
Also, Japanese SF is heavily influenced by American SF. When I'm editing these books, I see these references to Isaac Asimov and to the Cold Equations, A.E. Van Vogt, Frederick Brown, very classic American science fiction authors. They're widely translated and widely read over there. And so it's more accessible in a lot of ways than, say, some Japanese mysteries are, because Japanese mysteries tend to be structured very oddly to an American eye or to a Western eye.
And yet we like the horror.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. We really like the horror.
At least in movie form.
I should say we don't like their horror. We like to translate it into our own versions.
Yes.
And yet, most people, if they go back and watch the original versions, are like, wow, that's a way better movie. And, mm-hmm. Because it usually is. So,
well, horror is all about finding that exotic thing, that unusual thing. So if you're a horror fan, on some level, you're trying to find something that you've never seen before. Because horror, if you see it over and over again, it pales. Right? Your senses get deadened to it. So there's a bit of novelty seeking inside horror. And, of course, inside science fiction, too, you know. And what's another way to build a spaceship? What's another way to look at a first contact story? So I think those popular genres are more amenable to translation than, say, a story about everyday life or a realist story, that kind of thing.
Well, because they share... I mean, I guess you could say that, like, with science fiction, I mean, there's a shared lineage in a way.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Shared lineage and shared language.
Yeah.
We know that faster than life is something very important and very difficult to reach. We know that aliens are not just... human beings with their own cell phone numbers complaining, when they call Earthlings.
I don't have any signal on Mars.
Yeah.
Okay, so I really wanted to switch gear because you have a novel that just came out called Sensation.
Two novels. Yes.
Two novels, yeah.
One's called Sensation and one's called The Damned Highway with Brian Keene. I take it you read Sensation.
I haven't finished Sensation.
That's okay. The ending's terrible.
But I do...
Where you are.
I'm actually rather fascinated by it. Yeah. In a sort of, like, you kind of are mind, like, bending my brain. Because I'm not used to reading, usually when we read books for this show, there tend to be, I don't want to, like, degrade the value of the stuff we read, but they tend to be sort of standard, you know, usual sci-fi fantasy kind of stuff, right? You know, they do interesting stuff, but it's still, you know, in the standard writing.
This is the fantasy idiom or the fantasy mode.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And this book is not.
Yes.
Like, even just the first chapter, if anybody just reads the first chapter, you'll understand what I mean. Like, so one of the things I want to talk to you about is Sensation, the way you construct the sort of the perspective, the narrative's perspective. I mean, you constantly evoke the audience in this. You say we and you know, and you say you and all of this and these, it just in this first chapter alone. Sure. I'm very curious, what was the impetus behind this kind of a, because it does break from the narrative to bring us into it suddenly and then goes back to talk about your characters. So what was the impetus behind this? Why go with this?
Well, briefly, to let people know what it's about human history and how it's controlled by parasitic nematodes. Specifically, a species of wasp that preys upon a species of spider and makes a spider... create a different sort of web, and while the wasp eggs pupate, the new web can hold up these spiders and allow for the wasps to mature and consume the spider and go and reproduce. In my book, the spiders are actually a collective intelligence, so they narrate the book from first-person plural. We are saying this, we are telling you this, that kind of thing. And basically, I guess it's a metaphor for social change and revolution and that sort of thing. Right? There are forces of reaction and of the status quo, and there are forces of radical change. And I was just interested in playing with those things. And I used this actually existing spider wasp species, you know, dyad or symbiotic relationship to talk about these political issues that were amusing to me. And I always am interested in point of view and how information changes depending on how you change point of view. So a lot of my stories and a lot of my books deal with manipulating point of view. Like my previous book, Under My Roof, is first person singular, but from the point of view of an omniscient kid. He's a mind reader, can read anybody's mind in the world. So you can tell, he tells a very different type of story than a first person kid otherwise would. And that's just basically how I think. I start formally. I start with a point of view or structure, or how many chapters should I make this? Then I think of a story to fill out that structure. It's just a different way of thinking.
Okay. Would you consider yourself a postmodern writer?
Yes and no. Which, of course, is a postmodern answer, right? Because I guess there are two kinds of postmodern writers and two kinds of postmodernity. The two kinds of postmodern writers are, in my view, people say, I am a postmodernist, I am destroying modernism here, I'm using these techniques, and I'm presenting a postmodern point of view. The second kind would be everybody. Everyone's a postmodern writer because we're all in a postmodern condition, right? We're all in the cultural logic of late capitalism. So right. Everything we do is postmodern because we're sitting here living in 2011. So, yes and no. Also, what is postmodernism? Is it something that's really existent? You know, when we talk about postmodernism, as you are now, Sean, often people think, well, it's about doing these crazy things with books and different narrative structures and different wacky things. But you can find these different wacky things and different structures of metafiction and using typographical trickery way back, you know, thousands of years ago. There's metafiction in the Iliad. There's metafiction in Don Quixote. Metafiction in religious texts and postmodern techniques in religious texts from thousands of years ago. So is there anything, was there ever really a decisive break with modernism? I guess I would say no. I would say we're still in the modern era, so I am a modern writer.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of, as a teacher person, I teach literature occasionally. And that's part of the thing, too, is I want to teach postmodernism, but I had to be very honest with the students saying, I'm not entirely sure that postmodernism actually exists.
Right, I'm the same way. I don't know whether it exists or not.
I mean, it is very interesting to talk, though, because, I mean, you're right. A lot of the strategies which are applied to postmodernism, the metafiction, mm-hmm. the experimentation, all of these kinds of, there are dozens of different things, and it depends who you listen to.
Right.
A lot of those have existed either collectively or individually throughout literature.
Sure. No, I will say I wrote Sensation based partially on a call I got from my agent, my literary agent. After Under My Roof came out, she said, oh, the book's doing okay, but it's not doing great. And I think the problem is, Nick, you're too funny. There are too many jokes in this book, and they make you laugh, and that's not good. You should write a book like Don DeLillo writes books. His books are full of jokes, too, but they're not funny.
That doesn't even make sense.
I know, but that's the advice I got. So I tried. So I tried to write a Don DeLillo-type novel, and people will often call Don DeLillo a postmodern writer. So often, so in a way, I'm explicitly being influenced by postmodernity because I'm trying to make my version of a Don DeLillo novel.
I can kind of see, because there is a humor to the how much I've read of Sensation. There is like a humor, but it isn't funny in a ha-ha way. It's kind of like, I feel bad about laughing about this because this is actually terrible.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because one of the characters, I mean, I'm not ruining anything from the first couple of chapters.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Where essentially one of the characters we find out has been infected by one of these wasps and just goes crazy, essentially, and just, like, in the middle of sex, just decides, I'm done, I'm leaving you, and, like, leaves. And is gone.
So it's not the funny ha-ha, it's the funny weird.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you feel bad for this poor guy. And I'm kind of laughing about it, which is maybe disturbing.
Or awesome,
yeah. Yeah, it is a very interesting book. I mean, and even just the playing around with the insects. The second you started throwing out the information about this wasp, it was like, I know exactly what you're talking about. Even if I don't know the scientific name of this wasp, I know what you're talking about. And Right. You've already just creeped me out. Because that the wasp, parasitic insects of any description to me is just terrifying.
Especially when they're parasitic manipulators, not just drawing on your blood, they're actually changing your behavior. For their own evolutionary strategy. That's very creepy to me as well. Oh, yeah. And I've got a horror background, so it was interesting to have sort of the horror theme and the science fiction theme and the postmodern theme and the satire theme all going at once in the same book.
And it is interesting. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jen.
It's okay. I'm just assuming that's why these parasitic, you know, manipulators are such effective ways to convey things like governments, media, etc.
Right. Yeah, and at a certain point in the book, they capture this woman, the spiders do, and tell her what happened to her. And tell her what they're going to do to her. And the book itself is that for the reader.
Oh, interesting.
That the book itself is sort of like telling you that you've been stung by this wasp in a way, and that the spiders are letting you in on the big secret of humanity in order to move you to a different type of world.
Now, going back to the parasitic insect, because there are a lot of parasitic insects, and not just insects, but even just parasitic stuff.
Sure.
And since you said you came from a horror background, I'm very curious. Like, I mean, do you think that what is it about those kinds of animals that? Because there's all of these like Discovery Channel top 10 most parasitic evil animals. Like,
really?
There are Animal Planet. I'm sorry, not Discovery. They did. They did one of those like top 10 of the most parasitic insects.
Discovery and Animal Planet like their top 10 most terrifying things of all time.
Yeah, they really love those.
On TV, so I don't know. I don't know these things.
Okay, I mean, it was a while ago I saw these. But I'm just curious, like, do you think they're... What is it do you think is so terrifying about something that is like this wasp, like this parasitic being that can...
Parasites in general are frightening because you don't even know you're infected. often. You may be tired or listless or whatnot, and they're just, they are sucking on you. You become the environment for them. My dog had fleas last week. That was very frightening. To see, oh, there's a flea on her. Now what do we do? And we had to, wonder if there are fleas around. We started feeling itchy ourselves, talking about fleas. If fleas were on us, and they weren't. We weren't being bitten or anything, but it's just the notion, right? We're prepared almost in our autonomic nervous system to beware of a parasite. Now, parasitic manipulation is even scarier because, of course, we believe ourselves to be individuals. We believe ourselves to make our own decisions on some sort of rational basis. Right? Everybody else is a nut, but we're always making rational decisions. We're in control of our own lives. We're in control of our own fates. And yet now, something else, for entirely different reasons, unknown to us, and even unknown to them, are controlling our behaviors. That's extremely frightening. Why did you start this podcast, Sean?
The WhatsApp told me to.
Could be. Just to get me on here a couple years later and promulgate this message, right? Anything like that could be happening.
You're ruining my day, man.
Yeah, it is.
Do you think that's a more modern fear, though? I mean, the idea of somebody manipulating us?
Possession of cursing, of hexes.
Oh, good point.
A sort of a scientific gloss on an ancient fear, I'd say, I guess. The difference being, there are parasitic manipulators that control humans. Not in a very obvious sort of way, but toxoplasma. Why should a pregnant woman be around cats? Because of toxoplasma.
Mm-hmm.
You can end up with a schizophrenic child, at least according to some studies anyway, right? So who knows how much we're being controlled?
Yeah, that's a really scary thing, because we know in the animal kingdom that there's certain parasites that can control ants and make it so that they climb to the top of the leaf and get eaten.
Right.
To spread the infection.
Toxoplasma, it makes a rat not fear cats. So they're more likely to be eaten by cats, and toxoplasma reproduces inside a cat's intestinal tract.
Whoa.
Yeah, creepy, huh?
You know, when you put it that way, because they definitely didn't put it that way to me when I had kids. It's suddenly much scarier.
It is, yeah.
And I hadn't even heard the whole, schizophrenic child thing. So, yeah. Oh. They'll learn something new every day.
I don't know if that's definitive scientific proof, but I think there were some studies saying that that's one reason to avoid toxoplasma if you're pregnant.
Fabulous. Remind me to take my cat up back and shoot him.
All right.
Cat genocide started here, guys.
No.
Another parasite has an anti-cat agenda, obviously. Yes.
Yeah.
So,
of course, we exist with benign toxicity around us at all times and parasites. So, yeah. You kind of just have to live with it.
That sounds like parasite talk to me, Jennifer.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I have, Cthulhu-type creature stuck to the back of my brain and saying all of this. Although I'm pretty sure Cthulhu would actually sound more intelligent than me.
No, but we're all just kind of like swimming around the big issue, which is essentially, how much can we determine free will?
Right.
At any point, whether it's parasites being involved, whether it's just our genes make us act in certain ways, whether subconscious forces, all of this is going against this idea that somehow we have true free will, that we can make actual choices.
Mm-hmm.
And even just culturally, if you just think culturally, we're conditioned in dozens of different ways that influence us to act in certain ways.
But of course, at the same time, culture is a movable feast. Ideology is incomplete. So we're not always persuaded by what we see on television or whatnot. So that's what I was trying to deal with. I'm ultimately a compatibilist. I believe that it's compatible to talk about predetermination or determined actions and free will at the same time. And that there's freedom within sort of a determined structure. And that structure can change, but it takes a lot of effort to change it. A 1,000 years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? One, there wouldn't be two single men with a woman who wasn't her husband involved in a conversation privately or publicly.
Yes, I'm going to be shot after this.
Absolutely.
With my cat.
Yes. Oh, and she has a cat, too. That's even worse.
I'm a witch.
So things change, and things change for the better. But how do they change for the better, and what do we... how can we make them change for the better was sort of what I was getting at with sensation. A lot of sensations about sort of street politics and anarchist politics and that kind of thing, which I have an interest in and had some experience with. So I was sort of working out the 1990s, how the 1990s were for me in this book as well.
So what's the other book that you have coming out?
It's The Damned Highway with my friend Brian Keene. Dark Horse put it out. It just came out a couple weeks ago, and basically it's a Cthulhu novel. It's a Hunter S. Thompson, or Hunter S. Thompson-like character, during the 1972 elections, going to New Hampshire to cover the primary there, but taking a wrong turn basically into Arkham, Massachusetts, and discovering that Nixon is the head of the Cthulhu cult.
Oh my gosh, really?
Yes.
That's awesome.
So what themes do you explore in this one? Or is it just more of a fun romp?
Well, there's a political theme again. I sort of talk about how the two major parties have de-aligned, which is what happened during the early 70s and why they de-aligned. And now, of course, in our version with Brian, it's basically the conflict between Cthulhu and Moloch, the biblical demon that is often used to refer to heavy industry and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of fun in it, too, a lot of crazy things. And J. Edgar Hoover is in drag in it and all that kind of wacky stuff as well.
It sounds like this is like a book that you really set out. You just wanted to have a whole lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to work with Brian Keene because he's a friend of mine and he's a good guy and a good writer. And I've never really collaborated on a whole novel before. Also, I'm very lazy. My novels tend to be pretty short. So I figured, if I get Brian to do half the work, it'll really get a little longer and maybe get a little more commercial. And it did. So it was great.
It's fantastic. So, okay, so kind of winding down a bit here. So what... Let's start first with Haikusuro. What is coming up from Haikusuro like in the next 6 months?
Well, we have coming out very soon a book by our first female science fiction author. We've had some female fantasists, but not a science fiction author before. Called The Cage of Zeus, which is a hardish science fiction novel about genetically engineered intersex people or bigendered people on a space station orbiting Jupiter, and the conflict with their existence with sort of political reactionary people. We have the greatest science fiction novel of all time in Japan, according to a poll of the fans. 10 billion days and 100 billion nights, which is basically about the history of the universe. The first 50 pages are basically the evolution of trilobites on Earth and alien interaction with the early life forms. And it moves on to meet Plato and Siddhartha Gautama and Jesus Christ, then into the far future, then toward basically the heat death of the universe. And of course, there is a cyborg Jesus and a cyborg Buddha shooting each other with nuclear missiles at certain points in this book. So we're looking forward to that a lot. It's going to be a hardcover coming out in November.
Fantastic!
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And we just put out, as I mentioned before, Aiko by Miyuki Miyabi, which is based on the famous cult video game Aiko Castle in the Mist. This is the video game that Guillermo del Toro has pointed to and says it's the only masterpiece in video game art. And it's far better than the average sort of novelization as well. Also coming out, we have a book called MM9 for Monster Magnitude 9. Basically, it's sort of a Godzilla type of book, except done scientifically, in that they're treated like weather or earthquakes, and about sort of the public service response to all these monster attacks. And that's by Hiroshi Yamamoto. Who we did a novel with a couple years ago called The Stories of Ibis, which is really well received. So I think MM9 will be a lot of fun.
Cool.
And a few other things. We're also doing an anthology, which will actually have some American and other Western writers as well. It'll be half Japanese writers writing that will translate their stories, and half Western writers writing on Japanese themes. Sort of a meeting of the cultures or a meeting of the minds.
Oh, that'd be cool.
So really quick.
Future is Japanese. Mm-hmm.
Does Haikusuro tend to do books that have been released recently in Japan, or is it more of a mix?
Generally recently with some classics, like 10 Billion Days, okay, and 100 Billion Nights is a classic from
right.
The 60s. Rocket Girls is from the mid-90s, so nobody has a cell phone in the book. others are pretty new. Harmony by Project Ito, which won the special citation for the Philip K. Dick Award, had just come out a couple of years previously in Japan, where it won the Seiyun Award and the Japan SF Award, or the equivalent of the Hugos and the Nebula. Some are really fresh. Some are a few years old. Some are a little bit older. But for the most part, except for the occasional classic, they tend to be at least this decade.
Okay.
Or at least the last 10 years.
That's good. And what, then, can we expect from you in the near future, other than, obviously, Sensation and everything? So.
Oh, I got a bunch of short stories coming out and a bunch of anthologies. I've got one in Black Wings, too, which is a Lovecraft anthology. Future Lovecraft, a Lovecraft anthology. Shotguns vs. Cthulhu, which is a Lovecraft anthology. I've been busy with Lovecraft this winter. Next year, I have a zombie novel coming out called The Last Weekend. It's sort of zombies meet Charles Bukowski and John Fonte.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And I've got a book called Bullet Time coming out from Cheesy Publications next year as well, which, if I finish it on time. And that's basically about a school shooting and how well it goes.
Oh, what? How do you say that with...
That's going to be well received.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there are three different universes: one where it goes really well, one where it doesn't go very well, one where he doesn't do it, you know, and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Now I get it. I thought you. Yeah. We got to remember you write weirder stuff. Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
I was gonna say, like, you know, just following a bunch of kids who commit, just kill a bunch of people, and that's it.
And it turns out that you solve all their problems. Yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna be following your literature a bit more.
Great.
Because I'm very fascinated by these weird mashups, and it's just very interesting. All right, well, we're about out of time, so thank you so much for coming on and talking about us talking about Japanese SF with us and everything, and talking about your work. Really appreciate it.
Just spell the word Hakasuro for people who want to look on the website.
Yes.
It's HAIKASORU.com, and all our books are right up there. You can buy them right from the site. You can buy them any bookstore you like. We have excerpts. We have funny blog posts from me. And also the fun things over there at the website. So please check it out. Thanks.
And your website is?
Yes.
Oh, I've got nick-mamabass.com, but I haven't really updated that in months. I mostly just use my live journal on Twitter, honestly, which is easy enough to find.
Yeah. We'll make sure it's in the show notes so everybody will know. Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks again for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Caution. You have entered the podstruction zone. Please secure all podcatchers. Caution.
How's it coming, guys?
This won't go any faster if you keep interrupting.
Got it. Here's some steampunk, diesel punk, gothic punk.
Goth punk?
Gothic. Trust me on this.
Hey, you're the one who invited him to the show, Sean. I've got epic fantasy, sword and sorcery, and all the news on ebooks.
That's it. Check it out. Clock punk. Ooh, shiny.
I have space opera, time travel, Stargate, and...
Sean, is that He-Man?
Shut up. Boys, I think we did it.
A superior podcast.
Publishing, writing, genre, best-selling authors, and the hot new writers of today.
Editors and agents contests? Did we leave anything out?
AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com.
Subscribe today. Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature since 2006.
Sean?
It's just so beautiful.
Podstruction complete. Enjoy.
Our new intro music is Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction!
France, different planet. The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.